For BBS Radio, this is Lexi Ross with Health Frontiers. The issue around vaccine-induced diseases has been fomenting for some time, with very little of the research being covered by the mainstream corporate media. Our guest tonight is Dr. Rebecca Carley, who's one of the foremost experts in America, on the subject of vaccine-induced diseases. Welcome, Dr. Carley. It is a pleasure to have you on Health Frontiers.
Thank you, Lexi. And yes, may I say, as far as I know, I'm the only court-qualified expert in vaccine-induced diseases in the world. And the way that happened was quite a miracle. But yes, I've actually had a judge in a Bronx family court qualify me as an expert in vaccine-induced diseases, thus admitting in court that there is such a thing.
Well, how did that come about? I think rather than talk about that, I'd like you to discuss that maybe later in the show.
Okay.
I'd love for you to talk about, you know, how you got started as a surgeon, what brought all this to your attention, and how the subject of vaccines really, how you, became passionate about it.
Okay, well, I was trained as a surgeon at Kings County Hospital in Brooklyn, which is the busiest trauma center in the United States, if not the world. And I was carrying on with my profession. I had plans on eventually someday being a pediatric surgeon. That was my goal, until it became very obvious to me that there was a lot of corruption and fraud happening in the surgery department. Our surgery chairman was committing research fraud, and there was a lot of experimental surgery going on with people and things of that nature. So I actually left surgery in the early 90s. I was also an attending physician at the same medical center in the emergency room department. And I was kind of like trying to figure out, what am I going to do? And over a period of time following that, I was married and had to undergo all kinds of fertility treatments to have my only child, who turned 10 years old about a week ago. And I was taking him to the pediatrician and getting all his vaccinations like a good little sheep, as I was told in medical school that this is what you're supposed to do. And it was actually quite a synchronicity of events that occurred. I had a non-union fracture of my foot and a very serious case of endometriosis, and they wanted to do all kinds of very, dangerous medication for the endometriosis and surgery for the non-union fracture. And somebody told me about this entity called the naturopath. Of course, I never learned that word in medical school, but I ended up going to this naturopath for those two conditions, and she gave me these little sugar pills under my tongue, which cured both conditions. So then that's how I realized the reason I never learned about homeopathy was because it actually cures you. But she happened to mention to me that there were homeopathic remedies that could actually reverse the damage caused by inoculations. And, of course, this is the first time hearing that there is damage from inoculations. So I gave it to my son, who was about 2 years old at that time, and watched him become a different child. And that's when I realized that my son, in fact, had been brain damaged. He wasn't, frankly, autistic. He was speaking. But there was a lot of things happening with him that I didn't even realize until I reversed it with a homeopathy.
Well, what were the differences?
The only way I can describe it is he became a different child. He started being much more alert. He started talking a lot more. His motor development increased tremendously. I just saw a tremendous improvement in him over a period of a couple of months without even having realized that there was a problem, because it wasn't that severe that it was obvious. Remember,
right,
this was my first child. I trained as a surgeon, not a pediatrician. I didn't have a lot of experience with young children. And, of course, there's really no non-vaccine-damaged children out there to compare with. You know, it's very rare to find a, quote-unquote, normal child in today's society. So certain things that were happening, you know, I didn't even think anything of it. But as I said, once I gave him the homeopathic remedies, he changed into a different child. It was like watching a butterfly come out of a cocoon. And that's when I gave the same thing to myself. I had a number of different immune problems, and these dramatically improved, and my dog as well. I've actually reversed my dog of cancer. And that's what started me on this road about 9 years ago, actually, from when I started investigating these things. I had a television show in Long Island called What's Ailing America, where somebody had told me, you know, that I should be investigating vaccinations as they were watching my show, not knowing that these things were bad. All these things were happening simultaneously, and that's the reason why when I did go to the naturopath and she mentioned that there was a remedy to reverse the problems, it was, you know, a godsend. And that's when I realized, you know, I was given my job. I had no idea of the persecution that would follow from getting involved in this, but I feel very strongly that those in our profession must stand up and do the right thing because, of course, our profession is causing the worst epidemic that the world has ever known, which I call vaccine-induced diseases.
Well, what are some of the diseases that are caused by vaccines? I'd like to share a story that I have. I've been a holistic health writer for about 25 years, and I was doing a column up in Asheville for the Asheville Citizen Times, and I happened upon this woman who had a child who was born perfectly normal, and she took him in for his inoculations, and he had a cold. Well, she was taking him in for a checkup. And he had a little cold, and the doctor wanted to give him the vaccines. And she said, you know, I really don't feel comfortable giving him vaccines when his immune system is a little threatened. And he said, oh, don't be ridiculous. You know, he'll be fine. I'm going to do it anyway. So he went ahead and he gave the child the DPT shots. And the kid started screaming and screamed at the top of his lungs all
yes.
night long. And the next morning, he was
mm-hmm.
brain dead. And, of course, she started her path to educating people. But, I mean, I don't think people realize how deadly these vaccines are. And I know you really have a vast vocabulary of research and information. And I just want to, you know, encourage you to be as vociferous as you want to be on this issue because it's very frightening.
Well, it's pure evil, actually. And I do encourage your listeners to go to my website, www.drcarley.com, drcarley.com, where they can, first of all, look at some diagrams that I've put up there. The first diagram I call the big picture, which explains the cause of all disease on one paper. And, of course, basically you go from wellness to disease based on the number of assaults on your immune system. And once you reach critical mass, that's when your body develops a disease symptom to tell you you have a problem, you're doing the wrong thing, and it's time for you to change course. And, of course, right at the top of the page, I have vaccinations listed because vaccinations are what corrupt the immune system. If you go to the second diagram, that's the actual diagram that shows what the vaccinations do. And in a nutshell, the vaccinations cause immune corruption by two mechanisms. They can either shut down your cellular immune system, which are the T cells, the little Pac-Man cells that are supposed to be gobbling up the bacteria, viruses, and cancer cells. If the T cells are shut down, then, of course, you're getting all kinds of infections, which, of course, they're inoculating you with the infections, but you can't clear the infections if your T cells are not working. In addition, if you have any tumor cells, which, of course, we all do, it's a normal thing for you to have a few cancer cells in your body. If the immune system is not working in the cellular division, then those tumor cells will not be destroyed and you will get a tumor. Or, on the other hand, if the B cell system is put into hyperdrive, which is what happens especially when they put the adjuvants in the vaccines, which are in there just for that purpose,
now
to make the B cells go crazy and develop all the antibody, that's how you develop all the autoimmune disease. And when you asked me earlier what diseases are caused by vaccines, my answer is every disease you can imagine. All the autoimmune diseases and cancer. As a matter of fact, it's very simple. If you have a antigen in the vaccination, such as the measles virus, which looks like myelin basic protein, which is the covering of the nerves, then your body will develop an antibody against that measles virus. That antibody will attack your myelin, and that's what causes all the demyelinating diseases. And this includes autism, learning disabilities, ADD, all the neurological conditions. If the child dies, it's called sudden infant death syndrome, or shaken baby, depending on whether or not the child has any bruises on their body so they can blame the parent, and then you go to jail for life besides having a dead child. Not saying all cases of shaken baby are due to vaccines, but most of them are. And there's also, you know, Guillain-Barré syndrome, Tourette's syndrome, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig's. I've reversed all of these conditions with my protocol that I've developed that I call the Hippocrates Protocol, especially autism. I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases of autism that I've reversed with this protocol. But it's not just the neurological conditions. If you develop antibodies against the lining of the lung, you get asthma. Against the pancreas, you get diabetes. Against your own DNA, you get lupus. Against the joints, you get arthritis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The list is endless. And this is when I realized that, as I said, these inoculations are the true weapons of mass destruction. As a matter of fact, if your listeners go to my homepage, which I'm going to have my webpage redone within the next week so it's easier to read, but if you read my response to the CDC's Public Health Protection Research Guide, this actually gives quotations from various editions of a book called Harrison's Principles of Internal Medicine, which is the Bible that all medical students in the United States and probably other countries as well learn about this entity called, quote-unquote, internal medicine. And I've actually gone back, especially in the older edition. I have an edition from 1970, and it actually says different things about the vaccines causing this demyelination problem. As a matter of fact, the most chilling one that I saw was under a heading called Acute Necrotizing Hemorrhagic Encephalomyelitis. Now, what you have to realize, folks, is that what they do is they change the name of the disease. If you read the description of this entity, you will realize that it is, in fact, sudden infant death syndrome because the child is dead within, you know, a very short time. But they also mentioned that there's oftentimes multiple small hemorrhages, which is when I realized that it could also be shaken baby. But what's really chilling is it actually says, and I quote, that the entire clinical pathologic entity bears a close resemblance to a hyperacute form which can be induced in animals by administration of the pertussis vaccine.
Oh, so wow.
What they're saying is that experimentally, in animals, they cause this fatal illness where the brain turns to mush by giving the animal the pertussis vaccine. And if you read about subacute sclerosing pain encephalitis, it's the same thing. They're basically describing autism. They just changed the name. And these are all demyelinating diseases. And that's when I realized the entire field of neurology is basically vaccine-induced diseases. As a matter of fact, all the ologies, immunology, rheumatology, oncology, they're all vaccine-induced diseases. Someday, they're all going to be umbrellas underneath that title, and that's when people are going to realize how evil my profession has become, that they're causing all this death and destruction and suffering of untold proportions and then enriching the pharmaceutical cartels by creating drugs which only give you side effects. They don't heal anything, and it just keeps on getting worse and worse as they continue to increase the vaccination table for the children. As a matter of fact, if you get your child all the vaccines that the white coats want them to get, I believe they're up to 65 now by the time they're 5 years old.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm serious. And as a matter of fact, there's a white coat by the name of Dr. Paul Offit, who is a member of one of these pediatric review committees in terms of inoculations. And I actually have a tape recording of him on some show where he says that children can handle up to 10,000 vaccines at one time.
Oh, my God.
Now, of course, how could he possibly make such a ridiculous statement? And see, my answer to him with that is, well, gee, if they can handle 10,000 vaccines at one time, why can't they handle Cousin Johnny sneezing on them at a birthday party? How about if we just let them be, you know, naturally exposed to these different pathogens? It's totally insane.
Well, I mean, if you're giving the body vaccines instead of the body building its own immune system, right there you're weakening the system because kids get these diseases like measles and mumps and things like that, which actually build the immune system.
Well, now you're talking, Lexi, about the difference between natural immunity and artificial immunity. And this was another amazing revelation that I had because you have to understand that everything that I say in these papers as I put together the information quoting from the books are things that I realized. I did not learn any of this stuff in medical school. I did learn the term natural immunity versus artificial immunity, but what I realized the difference is that if somebody sneezes or coughs on you or you ingest some bacteria or virus, you know, a child playing with a dirty toy or whatever, there's something called secretory IgA. This is a very special antibody which lines the coating of the respiratory and upper GI tracts. And this is something the Creator gave us to start the immune process rolling. It's critical for that to be involved as the antigen is processed in order for you to get lifelong natural immunity, where if you're ever exposed to something, you never have a problem with it again. Your immune system automatically kicks in. And it's not just the antibody system, it's the cellular system as well. But when the white coats, those giant mosquitoes with their syringes, come at you and inject it right into your bloodstream through your skin, they're bypassing the secretory IgA. And as a matter of fact, another thing I realized by comparing the molecular structure of the IgA with IgE, which is the antibody of allergy, I actually realized that IgA becomes IgE once this process occurs. In other words, the IgE is a corrupted form of IgA, and that's how you get all the allergic reactions. So it totally corrupts the immune system, and I have a very lengthy explanation of that process in another paper on my website entitled Inoculations, the True Weapons of Mass Destruction Causing VIDS, an Epidemic of Genocide. And let me say, I have sent this document to professors of immunology at major universities, to Dr. William Atkinson, the head of the National Immunization Program at the CDC, to the heads of various pediatric associations, et cetera, et cetera. I've even offered a reward for some of these individuals to debate me on these issues, and I've had no takers at this point. Because,
sure,
you see, they know exactly
right.
What they're doing.
Absolutely.
Yes.
You have a term on your website, the humeral arm of the immune system. What does that mean? I've never heard that term, H-U-M-E-R-A-L, humeral.
Okay. Well, it's pronounced humeral, like tomato, tomato. But the humeral arm is the antibody arm, as opposed to the cellular arm, which is, as I said, the T cells and things of that nature.
Okay.
And what the inoculations do, as I said, when you inject them directly into the body and they put those adjuvants in there, which are made out of aluminum in most cases, although there's been other adjuvants used throughout time, and some of them in the Gulf War soldiers caused severe reactions. But
explain what an adjuvant is.
Is just something added to a vaccine. It's not a contaminant. It's something put in there intentionally to make the B cells go into hyperdrive. You see, the important thing for people to realize is that the immune system has these two parts to it, and they can't both work together at the same time. The way it's supposed to work naturally is that the B cells kick in first, and then the T cells kick in later. Once the B cells create antibody, and the antibody coats a foreign material, be it, virus, bacteria, or tumor cell, that's the way that the T cells are signaled to come in and gobble up that complex. That's how the T cells recognize that the antigen is a foreign thing that needs to be gotten rid of. But when they put the adjuvants in there, which in many of the vaccines are this aluminum hydroxide compound, that causes the B cells to keep on making antibody. They don't know when to stop. They don't know when to shut off. So all you do is create more antibody, 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 and this is what causes the autoimmune diseases to occur.
Well, so what you're saying is that no matter who you are, that something happens in your body to cause some type of disease. It may be SIDS in one patient, it may be arthritis in another patient, but every single person that takes a vaccine is developing some kind of disease.
Exactly. And this is where genetics comes in, Lexi, because you see, there's very few true genetic diseases. I could name a couple, cystic fibrosis, polycystic kidneys. There are a few truly genetic diseases. In other words, if you have a certain defective gene in your parents, be it recessive or dominant, and all that means is if it's recessive, both parents have to have it for it to express itself in the child. If it's dominant, only one parent needs to have it. But the point is, there's very few true genetic diseases. What you're inheriting from your parents is your constitution, and that is your immune system. And your immune system is what determines how much you can take. All of us has a weak link. In some people, it might be their joints. In other people, it might be their lungs. In many people, it's their brain. But whatever that weak link is, that's where you're going to be affected when the inoculations are injected into you. And if they would just leave their poisons out of us, of course, we would be fine. But by the inoculation of all these viruses, and there's other things as well, there's all kinds of contaminants. There's the cellular tissues themselves that they use to culture these viruses on. At least 13 vaccines are now made out of aborted fetuses, which is cannibalism for them to be injecting these tissues into people. Because, of course, there's no way to totally separate the culture media from the virus itself. No matter how small the filter is, you're still going to get proteins coming through from those culture agents. And, of course, many people have heard about the SV40 virus that was in the monkey kidneys that the polio virus was cultured on. So you see, you're much better off just getting the natural virus when Cousin Johnny sneezes on you than when these Frankensteins go to their laboratories and start playing with all their various vials and doing some things also that are very questionable. Because I actually have many books from the National Virus Cancer Program. And apparently they've been making all kinds of viruses to cause cancer, and somehow some of them seem to be ending up in vaccines.
Oh,
so
really?
There's all kinds of things going on, and this is such an important thing for people to get involved with, because, of course, if you don't have your health, you have nothing. If your brain is not working, you cannot logically and critically think and figure out and look around you in the world today and say, what are those criminals in the District of Criminals up to now? We have to have our health back. We have to have our minds working so that we can say to ourselves, you know, we're not going to pay for these things anymore.
Well, talk a little bit more about how the doctors experiment on patients without the patient's permission.
Well, that could be a whole day-long show in itself. First of all, when I was a surgeon, and this was back in the early 90s when I left, because it was bad enough then, you can imagine what it's like now. But basically, whenever you go into the hospital, there's all kinds of trials that are being done. You know, you always hear about clinical trials. And as a matter of fact, they get especially cancer patients all worked up and, you know, make them beg, oh, please put me in your cancer trial, because, of course, you'll get the experimental drug for free and they'll give you your examinations for free, et cetera, et cetera. So they make you feel so lucky to be included in these trials. But, of course, these new drugs, nobody knows or has any clue what the side effects are. So they never tell you the truly informed consent, you know, what the possible side effects are for the drugs or the surgeries, for that matter, that they're going to be doing, because they don't know. They have no way of knowing. And as a matter of fact, I would encourage your listeners to go to your local library and get a copy of the physician's death reference and look up any inoculation you like. I don't care what one you look up. And look and see under carcinogenesis. Has the vaccine ever been tested to see if it causes cancer? And you will find that none of them have been tested. Now, why have none of them been tested? Because they know that they cause cancer. Not only by the corruption of the immune system where the T cells, the cellular response of the immune system is turned off, as I said, but also because there's viruses now that cause cancer, and these are contaminants in many of the vaccines, such as the SV40 virus. So they never give you truly informed consent. So that's the first way they experiment on you. And then there's also the fact of certain things that happen in the hospital. As a matter of fact, I was shocked and disgusted to learn in New York, where I left last year, but now I'm finding out that this is true in just about every state. There's actually laws on the books, and it's usually under estates and trust law, which says that if a patient dies in the hospital, the family is, you know, eligible for a less of a monetary reward than if they're maimed for life. So if a doctor makes a mistake in the hospital, he actually has a vested interest to make sure you don't keep living, because he will get less of a damage charge against him should the case go to court than if you're maimed for life.
My dear, that is an interesting statement in light of the fact that most of the times when they make a mistake, you can't find the files. They vanish, because that's happened to several people I know.
Well,
I had a friend who went in for a gallbladder operation and her bile duct was cut, and she laid there in the hospital for 5 days trying to tell somebody that that something was wrong, and a nurse finally believed her. They had to go in and do surgery, and all the records were conveniently vanquished, whatever.
Right.
So
well,
the chances of anybody getting any kind of recourse in the hospital today is slim to none.
Yes, well, not only is that true, but you see, what many of the hospitals are doing now is they're putting all their records on computer. There's very few hospitals that now have hard copies. And you see, the reason it's nice for them to have them on computer is then they can always, like, change things where they have to. But
oh,
it's much worse than that, Lexi, because one of the other things that I do, besides teach people what I would do if I was they when they have all their different diseases, as I said, my protocol teaches them how to use homeopathic remedies to detoxify and other supplements to restore their immune system and their bodies that are not functioning, because I can't practice medicine anymore because they said that I have a delusion of conspiracy and wanted me to undergo psychiatric drugging, institutionalization, and or electroshock therapy to keep my license to kill. They wanted to do a chemical lobotomy on me. I've never had a single complaint against me by any patient I've ever helped since I was 16 and I started working in the hospital. So that's how the New York State Medical Board went against me. And let me say, any doctor that writes a medical exemption in this country loses their medical license. There is not one single doctor in this country at the present time that does so, and the reason is because they know what's going to happen. So I don't give medical advice. I tell people what I would do if I was they. But another thing that I do is I go into the hospital as a patient advocate, and it's even worse than what you're saying because I have multiple documented cases where elderly people are being killed. And the most common way that they kill them is with mismatched blood transfusions. They give them blood transfusions with blood that does not belong to them. This puts them into cardiac arrest. They end up in the ICU. The surgeons can, you know, do amputations of their limbs, put them on dialysis for a couple of weeks, and the next thing you know, they're dead. And I realize that this is happening because the Medicare Trust Fund is empty. It's a giant IOU. There's no money in there. So that is how they're taking out the elderly. And there's nothing you can do in these cases. The attorneys would never take a case. They would never sue the hospital because, as I said, under the law, not only is the hospital less liable if the patient dies, but the life is worth nothing unless they're earning a paycheck. And I had one case in Long Island where I reported a homicide in progress to District Attorney Thomas Spoda. And his detective waited until the patient was dead before he called me back. But he told me, and I have him on tape telling me, that the same hospital killed his mother, but there's nothing he can do. He didn't say committed medical malpractice or negligence. He said killed his own mother. And this is when I realized that the government agencies are all aiding and abetting in this. They all know that this is the MO. Take out the elderly. There's no money to pay these Medicare checks. They need to decrease the rolls, and this is how they're doing it in the hospitals.
Well, it's part of an overall plan to decrease population.
Yes.
I mean, it's become very obvious to me. I mean,
yes. Well, as a matter of fact, Henry Kissinger went before Congress in the late 60s, and I actually have a transcript of his testimony where he basically said, we must decrease the population because if not, our natural resources are going to be, you know, depleted. And so there is a conspiracy, folks. This is not a theory. It's a fact. And as you said, Lexi, it's becoming more and more obvious every day with various things that are happening in our world. They have no willingness or even any motivation to make people well. As a matter of fact, look at all the things they're doing to try to stop people from doing natural medicine.
Oh, I know.
Codex Alimentarius. I mean, we could go on for days. They're going after doctors like me. They're doing everything they can to keep people away from the things that are going to heal them because they don't want you to heal.
I know.
They want you to get sick, go on the drugs, pay them a lot of money, and then die as fast as possible.
That's right.
Right.
It's just they're shooting more poisons in your body, and people
yes.
just don't realize that. It astounds me that so many people willingly go to doctors that feed them. I mean, my own sister was on 15 different medications when she
wow.
died. 15.
And of course, you realize with a cocktail like that, there's no way that anybody could possibly know the cross-reactivity between those various drugs.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that happens, I mean, all the time with the antidepressants, because they give you one and then you don't sleep and you got to get something else to help you sleep, and then that one gives you another symptom. She couldn't even walk out into the sunlight because she broke out in rashes all over her body. Her liver was so toxic from the drugs they were giving her.
Well, I just have to comment on that, because first of all, it's really amazing if you look once again in the physician's death reference and you look up any drug, but especially the psychiatric drugs, you will in almost all cases find that the drug causes the very problem that it's being given for, such as antidepressants cause depression. But
right.
I also want to comment on what you said, because this is something I deal with every day in terms of the division among families. You often have, you know, certain members who worship the Church of Modern Day Medicine and, you know, believe in that baptism called vaccination, which starts at birth and just puts you on that road to death and disease. And then you have the other people in the family who are starting to ask questions and who are actually investigating for themselves and asking themselves, now, wait, let me get this straight. They're telling us to get away from all the, you know, backed up water, like when they have the mosquito season, they'll tell you empty those tires, you know, so you don't have these mosquito larvae coming into being and becoming mosquitoes, et cetera, et cetera. That's the problem. We don't want those mosquitoes injecting
right.
us with a virus.
Right.
But when the Waco puts it in a syringe, all of a sudden it becomes a sacred cow.
Right.
You know, how does that work?
It's just, it's confounding to me that people can believe it. But,
right.
you know, it's the death sentence with cancer. I mean, somebody gets cancer and the doctors convince them that they're going to die.
Right.
And to what I have learned is that cancer is just a signal that the body's out of balance. And then it can be put back in balance very naturally. But,
well,
you know,
they scare
people half to death, so they think they've got to go take chemotherapy and radiation, which kills you in 5 years.
Right.
You know?
Well, see, it's very important what you just said about that five-year thing. You see, that's why they talk about the five-year cure rate with chemotherapy, because they know that you're going to get a secondary cancer from the chemo 5 years after you have, you know, the initial tumor
that's
possibly
right.
go away with the chemo, because once in a while the chemo will wipe out the tumor. But they know you're going to get a secondary cancer after that, so that's why they talk about the five-year cure rate. But
right.
let me just say, and this is very important in terms of cancer, not only are they making viruses that cause cancer, but the cause of cancer has been known since 1911. I studied with Dr. William Kelly in Texas before he was died of mysterious circumstances last year. This is a man who cured 33,000 cases of cancer in 40 years, including his own terminal pancreatic cancer. And he studied the works of a man by the name of John Beard, who in 1911 wrote a treatise on the fact of the true cause of cancer being these particular cells in our body called trophoblast cells. Trophoblast cells are the cells that become the placenta when you're conceived. Now, what they didn't teach us in medical school is that some of those cells, the ones that don't become the placenta, actually go throughout your body and they're hiding in various organs. And they're not causing you a problem until you get hit with toxic chemicals. And once you have these carcinogenic stimulators introduced into your body, that's when the trophoblast cells become cancer. So you see, all cancer has the same cause. And while they're, you know, having their breast cancer society and their lung cancer and their prostate cancer, it's just a diversion because they're all from the same thing. Now,
amazing.
What Dr. Beard had realized in the work that Dr. Kelly did was to teach us the fact that digestive enzymes, a particular digestive enzyme which has something in it called chymotrypsin, will actually kill those trophoblast cells if the digestive enzyme is taken between meals. And that is the cure for cancer. The reason Dr. Kelly called me down to Texas to also give a lecture with him was because over the last few years, his therapy was not working as well, and he realized it was because there's so much.
Evidently, we have a caller on the air, Emma.
Okay.
So she should be coming on in just a minute. We've had some mechanical
Hello?
Difficulties tonight on air. So, Esther, are you there?
Yes.
Did you have a question?
Yes, I have a question. I have a couple of male callers, and I don't know... They don't give me good vibes, and I'm just wondering, if you see anything wicked there.
Oh, honey, we're not giving spiritual readings on the radio. That's not our purpose here. We're trying to talk about John of God, the spiritual healer. So I think you've misunderstood our purpose.
Oh, I thought the psychic.
Oh no, she's not a psychic.
Monique.
She's an author and a transpersonal psychologist, and she's not doing any kind of readings or anything.
Oh, sorry. It just I thought Monique was going to be on there.
No, no. You must be getting the shows mixed up. I'm sorry. We can't help you with that one.
I removed the caller.
All right. Emma, we interrupted you. You were talking about John having requested that you have some surgery.
Yes.
On your heart.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did he actually remove some sort of blockages, or was it more of an emotional kind of surgery?
Well, what it felt like to me when it was happening, and this was not physical surgery, it was what we call psychic surgery. But when it was, when I was in the process of having it done at the Casa in Brazil, it literally seemed like there were small hands inside my heart. And I wouldn't say it was physical blockages that any of our monitoring or diagnostic equipment would pick up, but some subtle energy blockages left over from hurts from the past in my life.
I see.
To heart problems later on in life.
Oh, but it probably would have. Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely. So what happened after that? Then, how long did you stay the first time you went?
I stayed for about 6 weeks.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And how many healings did you have during that time?
I just had one at that time, meaning one that was a formal surgery. But it's an extremely unusual place there. And this may sound very odd to the people listening, but surgeries can happen at any time. They can happen when a person's meditating, when they're sleeping, when they're just simply walking around in the area. And I've literally spoken to people who had like a spontaneous bleed where they had not run into anything or not punctured themselves in any way, and they started bleeding a little bit. Or they would be meditating and open their eyes after a little while, and it looks as if a scar was on, let's say, their hand or some part of their body. So it's
So this occurs like in the garden or in their hotel room or wherever they might be.
Yes, and it has even occurred to people when they're on their way traveling to visit John of God, or when they return home after being with John of God. But I wouldn't say that it's John of God personally who's doing it, because the place where John of God works, the sanctuary called the Casa Dominacio, is an extremely unusual place, and I think it's best to call it a portal. In other words, it's an area where benevolent spirits can be more accessible to people, and these benevolent spirits literally want to help with healing.
Well, now, explain how these spirits come through him.
Well, I'm not quite sure what I can say about how he goes into a trance, but he seems to be able to do it quite deliberately. I've seen him go into the trance, and he usually holds someone's hand and closes his eyes, and then a shudder will go through his body. And when he opens his eyes, it's clearly like a different presence is there. It doesn't take much time at all. It takes just a few seconds. And when his work is done at the end of the morning or at the end of the day, again, he'll hold on to the hand of a friend, someone that he feels closely aligned with, and bring himself out of the trance.
Interesting that he would hold someone else's hand.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think that might be an interfering energy. To hold someone else's hand. That's very interesting.
It is.
Well, can you describe some of the surgeries that you've personally witnessed?
Oh, well, one of the, I've witnessed many, and been very close up. One of the, two of the surgeries that he's most well known for, because he does them frequently, one, he scrapes the surface of the eye physically with a kitchen knife. And it usually makes people squirm to even think about it. And I must say, the first time I saw it, I had to hold myself back from jumping up, you know, and because I had a visceral response, like he must be causing this person tremendous pain. But if you take a split second to stop yourself and to look, you can see that the people he's working on are not at all in pain. They look completely relaxed. So one of the most amazing things to watch is that there's a kind of spiritual anesthesia that comes over people, so they can speak and they can communicate very lucidly, but they aren't feeling physical pain. And there's very little bleeding. Of course, with the eye, you wouldn't expect the same kind of bleeding as you would when he penetrates into the body with a knife, because he's just scraping the surface of the eye. But there are other surgeries I've seen where he does a hernia operation, or I watched him take out a benign tumor that was about 5 pounds in weight that someone had been carrying around in their upper abdomen for about 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was literally standing right next to her. She was one of the people that I was guiding. And John of God had asked for her specifically to come up to him at a certain time. He never does surgery unless someone is willing and wants it. But in this case, the woman was very willing, and she literally sat down in front of him at his, he guided her to the chair. And while she was sitting in front of him, she started having the spiritual anesthesia came over her, so she wasn't feeling pain. And he literally opened up her abdomen with a scalpel and began taking out this very large tumor. And it was her first day being at the casa, and I'm kind of laughing now because the woman had never left the United States, and she traveled from Montana all the way down to Brazil, and her first day at the casa, this extraordinary experience happened, but she seemed completely at peace. And I stood next to her, touching her actually, and talking to her a little bit and asking her how she was doing. She was absolutely fine. And I was stunned by the amount of material that was coming out of her. And the operation lasted about 20 minutes. I've also seen him do ovarian surgery while someone is standing up, eyes open, completely lucid, talking, if need be. And the second surgery he's most well known for is a surgery in which he actually inserts a part of something we call a special kind of scissors that's used in operating rooms, and he inserts it up the nose, and it goes, penetrates quite a distance, and if you see that surgery, you think, my God, this person's going to have, the scissors are going to penetrate into the brain, and it's going to lobotomize the person, or it's going to possibly kill them on the spot.
And what is he doing? I've seen pictures, I've seen videos of that operation several times. Is he going up to the, what part of the brain is he directing his scissors, and what are the results of that particular surgery? Because that was one of my friends here in Atlanta actually had that done to her, and I was curious as to what it does to the rest of the body, because my understanding is that when he does surgery, he may operate on one part of the body that's totally apart from the part of the body that's being affected.
Yes, that's right. But if we think about acupuncture, We've learned from the Chinese tradition that you can stimulate various parts of the ear but affect organs of the body, all over the body. And in a similar way, John of God might operate by scraping the eye or doing what we playfully call the nose job, which is this horrifying-looking surgery up the nose. But it actually can be affecting whole systems of the body or a certain part of the body that's very distant from the area that he's actually doing the physical operation on.
Has he ever explained what that particular surgery does?
No.
He hasn't. I would be curious to know that.
Well, many people are. And I interviewed a man who's actually a teacher at Harvard Medical School. And he had been down observing surgeries, and I'd interviewed him for a film I'm doing. And his name is Jeff Rediger, by the way. And Jeff was speaking about this, and again, he said, it's a mystery. You know, I've spoken to several doctors who've been very close watching the surgery. A dentist said, well, he's cleaning out the sinuses. But other people have said that's absolutely impossible.
Yeah.
And what comes to me, having watched it many, many times over, is that the surgery he's actually doing is on the energy body. And my guess is that the surgical tool, which is made out of metal, which he picks up and inserts into the nose, actually turns into energy.
That makes sense.
And then, thus, what's going on is that the energy is being directed into the brain in a laser-like fashion and possibly, I would think, to the pituitary or pineal glands.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, pituitary or where is the pineal is right in the center of the brain, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking he was affecting in some way. Well, how many times have you been down there, Emma?
I've been down 22 times.
Oh, my goodness.
Because I've been doing research not only at the CASA, because of the book that I wrote about John of God and his sanctuary, but I've also been doing research in other spiritist centers. So what I usually do is go down with a group and be a guide for them at the CASA and then do research in other centers.
Now, you've learned to speak Portuguese, haven't you?
Well, I'm certainly far from fluent, but I'm quite good at translating and speak basic Portuguese.
I see. Well, now, can you explain how it's possible that the spirit speaks through John? That my understanding is there's 35 or 40 different doctors that come through him to do the healing.
Well, what has been written and what is generally spoken about is that there are approximately 33 either physicians or theologians or
psychologists, I've even heard.
A psychologist, but also people who are very elevated in terms of their consciousness, who can come through him and manifest through him, take over his body, and use it for healing other people.
How does anybody understand, I mean, when you've written Kardec Spiritism,
mm-hmm.
and you might explain to people who Kardec was and something about this whole phenomenon of Brazilian Spiritism that kind of, it's interesting to me that it only developed in that one part of South America. I mean, things in different parts of South America, but it's not quite the same kind of spiritism that's practiced by John.
Well, this is a very interesting topic and very unusual because it's a worldwide phenomenon, meaning spiritism actually started with a Frenchman, Alan Kardec, and he lived in the middle part of the 19th century and actually wrote his books, one the most popular of which is the Spirit's Book, and then the medium's book. He wrote them after he had been to many seances and had interviewed hundreds of mediums, asking them all questions and then collating their answers. And the answers that were repeated by various mediums that didn't know each other seemed to him to be more what he called universal answers. Then he collated the questions and the universal answers and laid them down in an organized fashion, and that's what became the spirit's book and the medium's book. And so those books were actually brought back to Brazil by students of wealthy families who had been sent to the Sorbonne and other universities in Paris. So they brought spiritism back to Brazil, and then it grew there, meaning the principles of life that were laid down by Kardec took root there, and centers, which we now call spiritist centers, grew out of these principles.
And what year was that happened, Dr. Bragdon?
Well, spiritism really started taking hold in the 1890s. And there were homeopaths that had come over from Switzerland to Brazil to help people. And there were many, many poor people, of course, at that time in the 1870s, 1880s. And the homeopaths were working with the same kind of medications that we're familiar with, that the homeopaths use, and also had a sense of the subtle dimensions of life. And so they started bringing spiritism actually to their patients. And then the spiritist centers grew out of the homeopath's work.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, what year did Kardec originally write his manuscript?
Around 1860.
I see.
Yeah. But there were several books that he wrote. But the spiritist book was written, I think it's 1856 or 57.
So this has been going on for some time there.
Oh, that's one of the reasons I think it's so fascinating, is because these are community healing centers where people can go to get, you know, what we might call Reiki treatments.
Uh-huh.
But they can get Reiki treatments. They can also, if they need to get food or clothing, they will be gifted that, as well as gifted with being able to see a homeopath for free or get financial help for a period of time, but also get free dental work, free legal advice if they need it. I mean, it's a little welfare system in itself.
Now, does that
But on the other hand, they also are teaching people how to develop their psychic abilities.
Really?
And also their abilities to do healing.
Now, does that go on at John's Casa? Or is that at the other?
Well, that's generally available at most spiritist centers, but most spiritist centers do not have someone like John of God, someone as powerful in the way that John of God is powerful. So most spiritist centers actually are teaching groups of people to do spiritual healing, and so they work as a group of, let's say, 3 to 5 people working on one person at a time who needs healing. But John of God is such an unusual and unique healer. He has created a very unique kind of center where people come basically to see him, and then he has the support of many, many mediums who come to basically assist him to keep his energy stable while he's doing the healing.
That's what they call holding the current?
Yes.
Yeah. And how many mediums are there usually in the room to hold the current that supports his energy?
Well, there are 3 current rooms there, and on any given day there are about 100 people who are familiar with the work, and then there are other visitors who come in who also sit in current, some of whom have never been there before, but they're also lending their energy to support the work that's being done. So by the end of the day, you know, including the people who are coming for the first time, there may be 200 or 300 people, or even more, sitting in current.
Do you have to be a channel to do spiritist healing?
Well, if you're actually going to be a spiritist healer, there are depending on if you follow the rules that have been laid down by the spiritists that are part of the Federation of Brazilian Spiritists, then they ask you to do it in a certain way. But there are independent spiritist centers that do not subscribe to those particular rules and have explored other ways of doing the healing. But generally speaking, people do not do physical surgery like John of God does. He's unique in that. There are hardly any other people in Brazil who are doing that way. So it's a kind of spiritual healing where you don't touch the physical body and you're transmitting energy through your hands. And your hands are about 6 inches away from the body. And you don't need to be a channeler in particular to do this.
Is
but
that the kind
you,
of
you
work
do need
that...
to be able to focus.
Is that
so
the
that
kind of...
your energy is focused in a way to be of help to someone else.
I see. Is that the kind of work that Mauricio, I've heard about the Brazilian healer Mauricio, is that more like what he does?
I'm not familiar
people?
With Mauricio.
Really?
I can't tell you. Yeah.
Well, how do we know that there aren't negatively motivated spirits involved in spiritism? I mean, that's a question that comes up, for people over and over again. So many people that hear about John of God, that's the first thing they ask. Well, how do we know that he's not of the devil? Or, you know, how do we know he's not working with dark spirits? How does one know that in fact what he's doing has a pure source?
Well, if there are hundreds of people who come to see him, and there are many, many people, some say millions, who have been healed by him. And if he's really associating with negative or dark energies, why are people having healing? And why are people still drawn to him to have healing? I think that's very important question to ask. The other thing is, he's been completely dedicated to this work since the age of 16, such that all day, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, at the casa, he works from the morning until the last person is seen. And then frequently, he'll leave and he'll go fly to the south of Brazil, where he'll go into a place that we would call a stadium, full of people, and he will again do the same thing. He'll see everyone until the last person is seen for Saturday and Sunday, sometimes Monday. He has maybe one day free a week.
So he's doing this healing, and he sees, 1,000 to 2,000 people every day when he's healing, isn't that right?
Well, I've heard that in the 90s he was seeing that number of people every day. At the casa these days, 500, 600 people is more typical. But when he goes out, let's say, to the south of Brazil and is there in what is like a stadium, he will see that many people. And I gather in Atlanta they're expecting 1,500 to 2,000 people.
Yeah, we forgot to mention that John of God will be in Atlanta April 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, and he will be doing his healing, but as I understand it, he will not be doing the external surgeries, but only the invisible surgeries. Is that right?
That's right. But the invisible surgery, what I like to call etheric surgery, is really the basis of all the work that he does. And because we're so oriented towards physical matter, we think, well, you know, physical surgery must be much more powerful than the invisible surgery because you can't see anything happening in invisible surgery. But really the whole power of what he's doing is energetic surgery. And he's literally working on the energy body, the place where the seeds of illness are located.
Well, you've done a lot of research in... talk to various allopathic doctors about what John of God is doing. You explain that in your books that I would recommend highly to my listeners. The name of Dr. Bracken's books are Spiritual Alliances and Kardec's spiritism. Could you explain, you know, what are some of the reactions that you hear from doctors when they come down? I'm sure there's some doctors that might that make it down to Brazil, are there not?
Oh, there are actually more and more doctors who are going down there, some of whom have been already interviewed on network TV and speak about their experiences. And most of them are, if they want to, can come up and be next to John of God while he's doing his surgeries and observe very closely. So I have spoken with doctors who are skeptical, and I've spoken with doctors who are coming down there because they want to learn about spiritual healing and feel that it offers something, but they're not quite sure what. And all of the doctors I've spoken with have said that they've had profound experiences of a spiritual nature there that have opened up new doors for them in terms of the way they perceive healing, the way they think about healing, and how they want to do their work when they return home.
I think the listeners probably don't understand that when John does his healing, that it's not just a physical healing, and that he is doing this to bring people closer to God, and that he does a very deep emotional and spiritual healing along with the physical healing, doesn't he?
Well, I would say that the most important thing that goes on at the casa is that spiritual healing. And perhaps the most important thing that goes on in all our lives is a healing of the spirit. In other words, becoming more whole and growing our capacity to be at one with ourselves and at one with God in ourselves.
Well, he encourages people, to be more forgiving and to purify their lives. I mean, that's part of the whole visit down to the casa, isn't it?
Yes, and it's also an extremely important part of healing. Because the spiritist tradition believes that many illnesses can be traced back to experiences that we've had either in this lifetime or in past lives. And I'm certainly not going to say that everyone who is sick has done something terrible in a past life and is therefore atoning for it, because that's really unfair to take that position. But certainly illness is a wake-up call, and it brings people face-to-face with their mortality and brings a person face-to-face with what is it that gives their life meaning and what do they consider the most important thing about life. And what I've seen over and over again is that as people face their illness, they also reevaluate their lives and decide that love is actually one of the highest priority in their lives. And as they go deeper into their capacity to love, they also go deeper into their own spirituality. So
we could
call that a passage of spiritual healing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean, I think he epitomizes the whole concept of holistic healing and the mind-body-spirit connection. More than anybody, I suppose, that I've ever heard about, he does that. Let me ask you this. How important is it to have faith to do this work? I mean, I've interviewed myself a couple people who've been down to the casa that were very skeptical, and they didn't seem to come away with much. It was like they weren't open, or they didn't have the proper feeling of gratitude, or how would you determine that?
How would I determine? Would you ask
what? In other words, it seems to me that the people that go down there have to be open and ready to have the healing experience. Because I know a couple gentlemen that went down that were very skeptical and just sort of made fun of the whole process and didn't really seem to, they didn't have a heart of gratitude about having the opportunity to have a healing. And when they came back, they said they felt something, but I didn't feel like that they had taken full advantage of what was there, because they were blocking it themselves. And I was just curious if you see that a lot, or if you agree that it does take a certain amount of faith in belief to receive the kinds of healings that people receive.
You know, I think what it takes actually is a person willing to be receptive. And frequently when someone is highly skeptical, their mind is full of thoughts. Can I trust this? Is this okay? What is this person possibly doing that may be pulling the wool over people's eyes? You know, they're looking for the negativity.
Right.
And their minds are full with possibly judgment and criticism. And unfortunately, we are entrapped in our own training here, so that we feel that the closer that we can get to the guy that's called the miracle man, then the more healing we'll get. And it's all about him giving us the magic. Just in the same way, you know, if we get ill, we look up to see where can we find the best specialist who knows the most about our particular condition, thinking that that particular person is going to heal us. So if we transfer that way of being down to Brazil, then we go down to Brazil and we say, well, I need to be around John of God all the time, all the time. So we're constantly asking him to say something to us that we find meaningful, rather than do what he asks us to do when he says, go do your work, which means sit in the current room, pray for other people, and also keep your palms facing up in an attitude of receptivity, being willing to receive what the spirits and what our own spirit guides are willing to tell us and willing to give us.
So there is a degree of willingness in order to maximize your healing.
Absolutely. And I think going down to the casa with a guide can be extremely important, because the people who are have been invited to be guides down there can really assist people to detach from the training that we've all gotten to not to be receptive and to be in current, in the current room, and to receive what can be given there. And a lot of people who go down by themselves with somewhat of a program of this guy's got to be a hoax meet exactly what's in their mind, and they don't give themselves the opportunity to experience something that they don't know might in fact give them a tremendous amount.
So you don't have to have a specific religious belief in order to receive the healing.
Absolutely not. In fact, in the assembly room where people gather in the morning, there are paintings and poems from religions from all around the world. Everyone is welcome there.
That's wonderful. What would be the next step towards getting these kinds of centers open in the United States? And do you think that there's a possibility that that could even happen?
Well, there are spiritual centers in the United States. Most of them are oriented towards the Portuguese-speaking community, but there are some that are also available for English-speaking people, and the Brazilian community is actually wanting to encourage English-speaking people to come and participate in the activities. They're very charitable and giving, generous people. And spiritism is really a way of life that has to do with community and fraternity and strengthening that fraternity, which means gathering together and appreciating the spiritual aspect of each person and assisting in spiritual healing when that's possible.
Well, how would one find out about the spiritist groups here in America? And how many, I mean, are there a great number? Are they very common in large cities, or?
Well, they're most common in cities where there are many Brazilians. For instance, Boston, New York, Miami have several spiritist centers. There are also quite a few in New Jersey, around New York, and in the larger cities in Florida.
I know there is one in Atlanta, excuse me. I went there actually for a session last Saturday. It was very interesting. And I think they practice the method of Mauricio, the spiritist era that I mentioned earlier.
I see.
Well, and the thing that that I keep hearing repeated from the people that I've met, I haven't had the privilege of being down in Brazil yet, but the people that I've talked to that have been down there, they say that it's not just the healing that's taking place by John himself, but the loving atmosphere that is displayed by the people who work there, who come there, who that it's just the most supportive, loving family environment.
It is. It's extraordinary that way, and it's positive, so that people. What comes to mind is actually a man and his wife who had a little girl who was extremely ill, and she'd had several cancer surgeries by the time she was 2 years old. And they had been spending most of their time in hospitals, you know. And they came down there and they said, everybody's so positive and everyone's smiling, even though they're, many of them are ill, and we can sit down with anyone and talk easily. When they came back to Canada with their home, with their child, their minister came to visit them and walked in, and he started crying. And they said, what is it? And he said, I've never before experienced the presence of God so strongly as I do in your home right now.
Wow.
And I think that says a lot for what people get at the casa. They truly, if they're open to it and they're willing to receive, you know, what is there, they experience a great deal of love and gratitude for life and ease of connection with other people. And many people have very powerful experiences of the presence of God or the presence of benevolent spirits.
Would you say that that's probably the most important thing that you've taken away from your experiences with Son of God, that loving feeling?
Certainly that loving feeling is extremely important, and it certainly inspires me to go back for more and to bring people who are looking for healing to that place. But I would say the most important thing that's gone on in my own being as a result of my time there has been to say that it's not about preserving the body as long as we can preserve it. And that's a very different way of looking at life. Most Americans, and probably people in most of the developed countries, have been conditioned to believe the most important thing to do in life is to preserve your life and live as long as you can.
That's
which is
true.
Actually a very materialistic point of view.
Absolutely.
And maybe we're really here to grow on a spiritual sense and to use all of our experiences here as grist for that mill.
Well, that's what the Vedas teach, you know, that we're here just to keep elevating our soul and purifying our soul in every lifetime and every opportunity that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole materialistic viewpoint that we have in America is just the total antithesis of that. But, Emma, I think we're about to run out of time, but was there any other comment or thing that you wanted to make about John that really has touched you so deeply?
His dedication to his mission is extraordinary. And every day, at least once, he will repeat the phrase saying, it's not I, but God that's doing this work. He doesn't associate himself as being a spiritist or Catholic or anything else. He says really his dedication is to God. He was given his mission by God, and he wants to perform his mission as long as he can. He hopes it'll be for 100 years or more.
Isn't that wonderful? Well, I just thank you and bless you for spending this time with us and talking about John of God, and I just hope all of us can have the opportunity to touch such a wondrous being, and I hope we get to talk again soon. And good night, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Lexi, for this opportunity. Good night.
Good night. This is Lexi Ross for Health Frontiers, and we'll be seeing you again next week at 7 o'clock. ¶¶